here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week, it's going to be the turn of the American singer, songwriter, and guitarist. It is the one and only Peter Case, who I spoke to very recently to find out more about life, love, and poetry. Has been in a lot of bands and a lot of musical combos, including The Nerves in the mid-70s. They wrote the song Hanging on the Telephone, which was later recorded by Blondie. Then he formed the Plimsolls, various other bits and pieces, but has had a very prolific solo career and is currently just brought out a new album. And he's going to be on the road with Dan Stewart in America and also in the UK. He's going to be with Sid Griffin. So anyway, after several minutes of interest and but casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. Peter, it is over to you.
I'm from a family. There was a lot of music in the family. My big sister is 14 years older than me. I was the youngest child in the family. So we were up in the Buffalo area. My big sister played, she was a rock and roll fan in the original rock and roll fandom of the 50s with Fats Domino and Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry and all that. So that's what was in my house. She played piano and she was an excellent pianist and she could play by ear, you know, and she played like Fats Waller type things and Fats Domino and all that. So she was, that was in the house and it got kind of got in my body from that. They loved Elvis and all that. Then my own, then they went away to college and they came back with Joan Baez and Bob Dylan stuff. Mm-hmm. And I loved Bob Dylan bringing it all back home and all that. I got into that at a really young age. And I played in garage bands, you know, too, for quite a while. So if for a while there, I was playing folk gigs when I was like about 14. I would play at a coffee house. They used to have all these like coffee house, church basement kind of gigs, you know, where everybody would come in and play their acoustic music in the 60s. And then I would play in garage bands on Friday and Saturday night, go out and play dances, you know, and I played a lot of dances for you'd play the hits of the day, everything from, you know, the, you know, rock and roll, the Standells and the, you know, Young Rascals and all that kind of music. And so so I came from a background of playing acoustic. I got into country blues music when I was a kid, as much of it as was available. And I began listening to Josh White and Lead Belly and Mississippi John Hurt, which were the first things that were available at that time. I saw Lightnin' Hopkins play when I was like at 16, I hitchhiked up from Buffalo to Boston, which is about 500 miles or more, 600 maybe, I don't know. And I got over there in the middle of winter and saw Lightnin' Hopkins play a show up there in Cambridge. And that was very inspiring and illuminating, his storytelling, his guitar playing, his singing, everything about it was super. And so those were the things that inspired me. But another thing that really inspired me was at that time, a lot of people played solo. And so I'm still solo. I play solo gigs. But the people that played solo, like you didn't feel like you were hearing somebody unplugged. You thought you were getting the whole picture. So I saw, you know, Lightnin' Hopkins and John Hammond Jr. and Laura Nyro and Arlo Guthrie and James Taylor and Joni, you know, Judy Collins and just all kinds of people playing these incredible solo gigs, as well as people that weren't so well known like Dave Van Ronk and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I saw all those people play as a kid and it was very impressive to me to I still love that, you know. I love listening to Robert Johnson just playing solo on a record, you know. And yeah. So that's where I'm at. I don't really necessarily need to hear drums. I already hear it all in my head anyhow. So
absolutely. Did you sort of, when you got to sort of 1967, this was being the Summer of Love, we had there was the sort of the gathering of the tribes in San Francisco, Golden Gate Park, with, you know, the Grateful Dead and Ginsberg, and there was Timothy Leary. Did the Summer of Love sort of have an impact on your childhood at this stage?
Yeah, it did, but I wasn't here. I was in Buffalo, New York. And so in the Summer of Love, 67, so-called Summer of Love, I was with my big sister, and she took me to see the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead in Toronto. In late July, I think, 1967, I saw them play, and that was very impressive as well. I loved the Grateful Dead. I loved the Airplane, too, that Surrealistic Pillow record. I loved the great songwriting and the great singing in both those groups.
Yes. And what was the sort of New York scene? Were you sort of aware of the Andy Warhol factory and the Velvet Underground? Was that sort of kind of in your consciousness, or was that something that didn't, it passed you by a bit?
No, I listened to the Velvet Underground. In the late 60s, I hung out at a pad with, like, you know, I was pretty young, but like there was a bunch of hippies that had a pad and they had their records there, and they had the Andy Warhol banana cover record. And I didn't like the whole thing, but I really loved Waiting on My Man, and I liked Heroin. You know, those were my two favorites on that record. And I would listen to those over and over again. But, you know, especially Waiting for My Man, I just, that groove on that, you know, really killed me. But, you know, they weren't legend yet at that time of Velvet Underground. You know, I listened as much to the Incredible String Band or to the Creedence Clearwater. Yeah, there's so much great music around at that time. Hendrix was a really big influence in a way. His just beautiful flair with songwriting and singing, and you know, so.
What was kind of, because then, so 2 years later, Woodstock, did you hitch to upstate New York, upstate, and go to Woodstock at this stage?
I was on LSD that weekend and I was too high to make it to Woodstock.
There you go. Probably the story.
I was on my way in a car with another guy. And we were both on Orange Sunshine Acid and we did not make it, but we ended up out in the middle of nowhere. We were too high, man.
Yes.
Too high for Woodstock.
Well, there you go. Too high for Woodstock. I'm going to make a note of that. That's a good one. Too high. That's excellent. Too high for Woodstock. Now, then, next, the following year, you know, you're 16, the end of a decade, beginning of the 70s, then sort of, you know, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, All Pass, Altamont, the 60s, you know, Charles Manson, 60s ends on a bit of a downer, doesn't it? And you're just at that age where your heroes, quite a few of them have passed. You know, we get freaked out when one person dies at 27. You had three. I mean, that's not good, is it? And they're major people. You know, we talk about them over 50 years later. They made the most amazing music. What was that like for you at that stage?
Well, life was so fraught with other difficulties. It was terrible that Brian Jones and Janis and Jimmy died and Jim Morrison, too. I loved all those people. But I had other problems closer to home, you know. The world was so insane at that point, and everybody was at each other's throats over the Vietnam War and over hippies and drugs. And I had to leave my parents' house, and I dropped out of school to play music with a band called Pig Nation.
And yes.
Pig Nation played loud three-chord rock and roll a la Plastic Ono Band live in Toronto. That was our big influence when I was 16. And so we were getting in trouble all over the place. We got editorials and people threatening us, and you know, it was very intense. And so, but there was also just a lot of trouble and a lot of insanity on the streets of the world at that point. In America, in Buffalo, you know, people were, you know, I remember going up, hitchhiking over to New York, and construction workers were coming off work and beating the hell out of anybody with long hair. And, you know, it was very, an insane time. And then a lot of people were starting to get, you know, addicted to hard drugs, and there was drugs all, you know, all sorts of stuff everywhere. And plus there was just a level of insanity that was like, you know, my sister had moved away. She moved over to the French Switzerland for a while.
Nice.
Well, you know, that's where she lived. And she came back in the summer of 69, and or maybe it was 70. I can't remember which right now. And she was, I think it was 70, 1970. And she was just in total shock about what had happened to America and how insane it had gotten. And she had like a culture shock to an insane degree. So things were going really, you know, the Vietnam War and other things just took life in general, you know, like they say, you know, just went to hell, you know, you know, school, I, you know, everything was disorganized and insane, and kids were hitting everybody was on the road, and like, you know, it was very, very troubling. So the least of our problems, I mean, it wasn't the least of our problems. It was sad to see Jimmy die. He was such an important figure, and Jim, and then, you know, Altamont, I didn't hardly even register, but at the time that didn't seem like, you know, I mean, I had other things on my mind, you know, there was like people getting killed on the streets in Buffalo. So, yes. You know, I lived across the street from a motorcycle gang, you know, like a real bad motorcycle gang. And we had to deal with that. You know, we didn't have Altamont. We had it right in our living room, you know, so that's what life was like there at that time.
Yes. I mean, that was your Hell's Angels. What about did the Mafia have much kind of impact around New York and Buffalo at that stage for you? The Mafia, were they sort of controlling much in that region? I remember talking to J.J. French from Twisted Sister, and he said quite a lot of the venues and places had kind of Mafia connections, which also brought a heaviness to his childhood at times when he was trying
absolutely, man. I mean, come on, man, the Music Union and all that stuff. You know, I remember everyone from, I mean, I don't know if it was the Mafia or what. I mean, I don't want to talk about that, but like, you know, I mean, I can't even go into it, man, but there was a lot of trouble. And like, I had one friend went over to the Music Union and there was nobody there. So he sticks his head into the back room and there's guys counting a big pile of money there. And then they grab him and they throw him up against the wall and they go, "Don't ever come in here when we're counting the money." And, you know, it was tough. There were a lot of tough people around.
Yes. Well, I sort
Buffalo,
of, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not to mess around. But then, you know, with the singer at the beginning, the singer-songwriter, you mentioned the Incredible String Band. Then you had sort of a lot of the sort of James Taylor, Carly Simon people, Joni Mitchell, and then sort of Laurel Canyon. Did you then sort of hit the road and go west?
Never a fan really of Carly Simon and all that. I mean, I think she's good and everything, but I was never a fan of all the Laurel Canyon stuff. At that point, I was becoming really entranced by blues music. And so, and being from Buffalo, there was a lot of people that played, a really rock and roll form of blues. And I saw Paul Butterfield play when I was in 67 as well. And he was a big influence on me too. I was just a kid and I went to a bar with my mom and dad and we saw Paul Butterfield blues band play in 1967. And it was so powerful to see Butterfield playing the harp, you know?
Yes, well, I could imagine that would have been.
Yeah, and so, and to see his, he was a performer, Paul Butterfield. You know, he was really a performer, and he came out and like just blew the place away with his vibe. And I learned so much from that. So, you know, and then to see Light, and then as I went on, I discovered more of that kind of music. And so I left California for California, not because of Laurel Canyon or anything, but just to get away from Buffalo. Maybe the dregs of the summer of love out in California might still be there. I didn't know, but I wanted to get as far away from Buffalo as I could without a passport. I didn't have a passport. I didn't want to go to New York because it was too close to Buffalo. And so I always had kind of a California dream, and I ended up in San Francisco as a street musician in 1973.
Yes, nice. I think it was Paul Butterfield had that brilliant bit at Monterey, didn't he, where he was saying, "It's really groovy, man. It's really groovy."
No, that was Michael Bloomfield.
Michael Bloomfield. I was so not close. Sorry about that.
Michael Bloomfield was a great player, too. I mean, that original Butterfield band with him in it was great. But I saw them right after Bloomfield left. Butterfield was different from Bloomfield. He was really a hard-edged kind of character, but he was really, really great.
Nice. We loved that as young people, listening to him. Anyway, look, as the 70s then progressed, we had heavy metal. We had the beginnings of, you know, heavy metal with Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, then glam rock with Bowie and that kind of scene, which started, and Roxy Music, which were the cool kids on the glam front. And then, you know, punk rock started to sort of develop with people like the Doctors of Madness and Dr. Feelgood. What was your kind of mid-70s period then in San Francisco like? Because this is where you begin, or your journey with the Nerves begins, isn't it?
I was playing on the street. I had a band that played on the street all the time, and we changed our name all the time. At one point, we were called Berry Berry and the Incredible Symptoms, and then we called it the Stumble Bums for a while. This is way pre-punk, and we were like kind of like living on the street and playing on the street. We slept in abandoned cars, abandoned trucks and stuff. And then, so we're out there, and then I met Jack Lee from the Nerves. We went and got high and smoked a joint in his car, and you know, he played me Hanging on the Telephone, and I played him a song I'd written called When You Find Out. And we started hanging out then. That was 74. And then we first played electric together in 75. And so I started learning how to play bass guitar in 75. And I joined the Nerves with Jack and this other guy, Pat, from they were both from Alaska, 75. And so really the band started going in 74, hanging on the telephone and all that was first recorded in 74. And then we started doing that. It was before punk and before power pop and before any of those kind of things. We just wanted, it was a real teenage form of rock and roll based on like 2 minute songs. And like, it's when I'd been writing my whole life. I started writing songs in 65, I wrote a song, but like in 69, I started writing songs people wanted to hear twice. But by the time I got to San Francisco, my life was in such an uproar. I wasn't writing songs. I was just doing all blues music, you know, doing songs that I loved by Elmore James and Sonnyland Slim and,
yes.
Lazy Lester and stuff like that. And so that's what I did on the street, but then, and Chuck Berry, you know, and all that kind of thing, and Bob Dylan for that matter. But then I got in the Nerves. And they weren't interested in Lazy Lester, Bob Dylan, or Elmore James, but they were interested in, they just wanted to like write these 2 minute songs, kind of very interested in the Beatles and the Stones and Motown and Bacharach and stuff like that. And so like, that's what we were doing, like a real fast, hard version of the Stones Aftermath or the Beatles Rubber Soul or something, but more, not even Beatles Rubber Soul, like earlier than that, you know, and not the Beatles though, more, it was more like the Stones songwriting, which had a lot of detail and the lyrics as well. The Beatles never really had that, you know. It had melodies, but it was more our music did, but it was also based on Bacharach, you know, because we would every once in a while use a fancy chord, you know. And you know,
yes, we love
Bacharach, you know. And so like we went on tour with the Ramones, and that was like, you know, when we first heard the Ramones, it was 76, and we couldn't believe how much similar they were, what they were doing was to what we were doing. They were more influenced by girl groups and the Stooges, and we were more influenced by, you know, what I just said, you know. And so, but we were all playing fast, and we used to play fast eighth notes, like hanging on the telephone, you know, dun, 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 you know. And everything was either, you know, fast, faster, faster. And so, that was the thing. And like we were, I think we had more punk attitude. Our music wasn't necessarily punk. It was Hanging on the Telephone, though, which became the first big worldwide hit for a new wave punk band, Blondie, whatever you want to call them.
You know,
Hanging on the Telephone was our flag, you know. And they took it, and they did two Nerves songs actually on that album, both of them by the guitar player in the Nerves, Jack. And so the Nerves broke up after that. But we went out and toured with the Ramones. We played with Pere Ubu and Devo before anybody knew who they were. We played with Mink DeVille, who liked us a lot and had us open shows. And then, you know, we traveled all around the country and met everybody on the underground in 77, you know, Steve Baters and all these people. And so we were...
You were there with... Dear old Steve Baters.
Yeah, we played Max's Kansas City for like a week in summer of 77. And, you know, members of the Cramps and all these people came out. So it was really an exciting, very exciting period.
Well, absolutely. And was it inevitable the band was going to not last particularly that long? Because you broke up, was it about 78, 79 time the band sort of...
What band was this?
The Nerves.
Oh, what happened? Did they broke up in early 78?
Well, yeah, 78. Was that inevitable that was going to not last for the duration of punk?
Probably,
as well?
Because we didn't know how to get along with each other. And like you had three really strong songwriters with me and Jack and Paul, and that we had a vision of what we were trying to do. But my vision was widening. You know, I wanted to include. So when I left the Nerves broke up because we didn't get along, basically. Like if we would have stayed together, we probably, you know, after the Blondie success, we probably could have been writing songs for a lot of people. That would have been great. You know, we knew how to do a lot of things pretty well, but one wasn't getting along. And so I decided the other thing, the Nerves was not a great live act. They were okay, but like they didn't. I wanted to put together a band that would do what the Nerves was doing with song, but kind of expand the influence to like cover more like the folk rock and like soul music and like more music that I loved from when I grew up. And I wanted to have a band that could just blow the roof off a club as well as having like the great songs, you know, that like the Nerves had good songs, but not great songs. I don't want to be unhumble, but you know, songs that you could blow the roof off of a place by the way the band performed. And so that's what we did. We did do it with the plimsolls. There was no doubt about it. We could like really go rock the joint. And so we would rock the house and we broke attendance records and Tom Petty and all these people played with us and on stage with us and Phil Lynott came out and sang with us one night. And, we had a lot of fans and we were doing really good, but things didn't work out for us in terms of we didn't make good records. It was much better live groups. So if you want to hear the Plimsolls, there's a couple of live records where you can sort of get the feel from it. They're out on a label called Alive Natural Sound, and the records are called Live, Beg, Borrow, and Steal, One Night in America, and the other one's called...
Is that Beach Town Confidential?
Beach Town Confidential.
Yes, my God. It is an amazing sound. Actually, both bands, I think, have got an amazing sound. Did it? Was it kind of tricky navigating? Because you were sort of in LA at that stage with both the Nerves and then with the Plimsolls, wasn't it? Did you stay in LA for the Plimsolls? Was that... That's where you were based.
Oh,
did you
yeah.
Did you sort of have, because in this country, we had the sort of pre-punk, then we had the real punk, then post-punk period. And then as the 80s sort of crept in, with us, we had Thatcher and then we had the various political strife. You had Reagan. Was it difficult to sort of navigate that kind of musical change in the late 70s and early 80s?
I suppose it was, The Nerves were always like left behind by like different waves that would go out. And so when the Nerves were out, punk rock took off as a big wave, but we weren't really included in that because we were doing our own thing a little bit. We were in a way because Blondie did the song, but it didn't really help the band. But then the Plimsolls, we put out records, but the competition at that point was more... It was during a period, it was difficult to get on the radio, with rock and roll. And so we did with a record called A Million Miles Away. We got pretty far on radio and we got up to like 69 or 68 on the Billboard chart. But that's not high enough to really cement your thing. And then you'd go out on the road and people wouldn't know who the hell you were, even though you were like super pop. We were super popular in all in California and Texas and everything. But then we go out on the road and you play like St. Louis or something. No, people would know you there, but there'd be a lot of places where they wouldn't. And you had to go out into these long slogs across America where it was very adverse. And, I've been touring America. I'm leaving tomorrow on another tour and I've been touring here for so long, man. But, it was a long row,
Yes. But then as the 80s progressed, we had that sort of the new Paisley scene that started to develop from especially the American period, didn't we? Like people like the Rain Parade and then the Bangles and is it 3 o'clock? And then sort of Green on Red sort of comes along as well. People like that. The Long Riders, we love the Long Riders. Did that kind of musical shift kind of inspire you during the 80s? Because obviously...
No, not at all. I mean, I was ahead of that, I didn't care about that. I love Sid. He was an old friend of mine from 77. But, I was already like at the end of the Plimsolls and starting my solo career. I wasn't influenced by the Rain Parade. Those people, they were like young kids. They were a lot younger than me, I was like already like way... I was in my second band breaking up, man, when the Dream Syndicate and all this. I admired them. I thought they were good, but they didn't really influence where I was going. What did was songwriting, Bob Dylan and the stuff I grew up on, everything from the that's what influenced me. I was no longer influenced by movements or anything at that point. What I was influenced by was trying to write songs that would just, you'd be able to just go walk into any place in the world and have a song that would just break people's hearts or take them away. And that was my whole art. That's where I decided to take my art, was just down to the basics of song. And so I wasn't any longer trying to chase like I was disappointed after the Plimsolls, and we didn't have a hit really with A Million Miles Away and all that. And I said, fuck it, man. I'm just going to go ahead and like just write my songs and like, just be into that thing in the basic, timeless thing of where, where you have a great song and you go sing the hell out of it and then people relate to it. I wasn't trying to, I wasn't reading the rock press or anything at that point.
No, but there's always a sort of a market, sometimes a bit niche for singer-songwriters, because you perform with or work with Victoria.
When I became a singer-songwriter, there was nobody else doing it. in my gang, you know, nobody was doing it. And, you know, John Hiatt was doing it sort of, and that was about it, you know. There were no, like, young singer-songwriters. I was, like, the first of that whole rock and roll gang to go solo and play solo like that. And people couldn't believe I was doing it, you know. But I could do it because I had the roots back from seeing, you know, Dave Van Ronk and, you know, all those people that I'd seen when I was a kid. And so, like, I really, you know, and I, you know, studied it quite a bit over the years. And so I was able to do that.
Yes, but it was a sort of a few country artists to start started to appear, weren't they? I remember seeing in the 80s Nancy Griffith. I know she's a bit more country. And then I saw a very early Lucinda Williams playing in a small club in London.
Yeah, Lucinda was a friend of mine. Like, she played one of her first gigs in L.A., opening for my group. I had this group called the Incredibly Strung Out Band, and that was me, Gerf Morlix, and a couple other people. And Lucinda opened up the show for that group one night, and that's how she met Gerf, who ended up being her producer. He was from my band.
Right.
And so we were friends with them from very early on, yeah.
And then you met up with Victoria Williams as well, who produced or recorded two of my favorite records, Loose and is it Swing by the Statues? God, I can't remember now.
Yeah, I met her in 84, yeah.
84. So was that, was she already a singer-songwriter at that stage?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, she'd been playing since she was a kid, just like me.
Yes. So how long did the Incredibly Strung Out Band last? Was this a project, kind of a sort of holistic, not holistic, but organic process or outfit?
Oh, yeah. We did, the whole idea behind that band was just to ride around in cars and play guitars in the cars and go over to people's houses and play and every once in a while get a coffee house gig. We were just like developing the style. Nobody else was doing that kind of thing at that time. And so we were doing Burt Jansch material and Blaze Foley songs and, country stuff. And so that's where that was coming from, 84 and 85. And then when I finally made my solo record with T-Bone and all that, you know, that was kind of the Incredibly Strung Out Band, like, was kind of a thing of the past.
Yes, and it was this one, Geffen Records. Did you get a deal with Geffen at this stage for your solo work?
Yeah.
And was it a two-record deal, three-record deal you had, taking you into the 90s with the man with fragmented neon classical?
Your traditionalist guitar, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a three-record deal, and... they wouldn't let me out of it. After the second record, I wanted to get out of the deal, but they wouldn't let me out.
Yes, there you go. And then did you just sort of then ignore everything that was going on and just stick to what you were doing at that stage with your musical direction in life as a solo artist?
Pretty much, you know. I don't know if I ignored everything, but I mean, I was aware of things, but... I was following my own lights at that point. I got pressured into making, like, the last record for Geffen. There was a lot of political pressure on me to do some sort of rock and roll record again. They didn't like what I was doing with the acoustic thing and the country blues and all that. Like, they didn't understand why I opened a record with a Mance Lipscomb song, you know, and all that kind of thing. So they wanted to pressure me. So I worked with Mitchell Froom, who just produced Crowded House. And
Suzanne Vega, I think, hadn't he? Or was he with Suzanne Vega? Wasn't he connected?
That was after my record.
Right.
He met her right after he did my record. He did work with her.
Right. And were you pleased with the results of that third album?
I hated it. Not at all.
There you go. And then...
it's my least favorite record. I hate that fucking record.
The
only good thing that happened was all the best songs he turned down. He didn't want to record any of the best songs. He just wanted to do the jingles, you know? And so I had a bunch of good songs left over. So when I got on Vanguard, I could make like that record Torn Again, which had all the best songs that weren't on that record.
Right, Torn Again. So that was one which you... that was your sort of mid-90s record. Then the Plimsolls reforms again. Was that quite a surprise to have them back together for 96?
You know, we went and played a benefit, and then we got back together again with the drummer from the Gin Blossoms for a while. And then we went and recorded with Clem Burke. You know, I mean, I don't know if it was a surprise. It was an attempt to do something. It seemed we still had some of that left in us. And, I hadn't completely, you know, I write songs the way they come to me. You know what I mean? I don't really sit down and try to, like, force different kind of things to happen, so because you can't really and be any good. And so I was writing my singer songwriter kind of songs, and every once in a while I would write like a plimsoll song, you know. It would be like, wow, this, because I know how to do that, and they would just come to me. And so that's what's on the record called Cool Trash. And so we made an album of those songs and went out and played quite a bit.
Yes.
But, you know, it's kind of confusing, and I felt like it confused everything. You know, I kind of knew where it was at, but in a way it even kind of confused me, because I'm playing rock and roll with the plimsolls. I've got a solo career, and the record companies would get confused, you know, like, what are you doing? And then you'd go on tour, and people would want to see one thing or the other thing. And it seemed like too much of a duality, and I dropped it.
I don't blame you. So when you put your set together now, and you're sort of out there as a solo artist, you've got sort of decades of material. How do you sort of pick your set list at this stage?
You know, man, I play the songs that really come alive for me the most, and that I really feel compelled to sing. So usually it's the songs from the last few records. Right at the moment, I'm playing the stuff from Dr. Moan. I'm playing the music from some of the songs from Midnight Broadcast. I play a lot of the songs from Highway 62. And then I play a lot of the songs from, so I'm playing the songs from, and then one called Let Us Not Pray, Sleepy John. And then I play a lot of the songs from the Blue Guitar record.
Right.
I don't know why, but I just play those because they're just songs that still live. Like they kind of have like a thing that, and I play a few songs from my first record, but the Blue Guitar, those records I just mentioned, Blue Guitar, Sleepy John, Highway 62 and Dr. Moan, that's pretty much what I'm doing. Plus, I play a lot of outside material. Like, so I'll play like other people's songs or old songs.
Yes, absolutely. So you got this tour that's coming up very soon. Well, next week, actually. So do you have to sort of...
I leave tomorrow, yeah.
You're leaving tomorrow for the road. Have you got a very committed fan base at this stage? I was talking to Bob Andrews, who was in Brinsley Schwartz and then the Graham Park and the Rumour Band. You know, he's finding a lot of artists that I've been interviewing have found that they've got quite a good niche audience at the moment who are very loyal to them. Have you found the same thing with longevity, that you've managed to sort of get quite a committed group of people that are supporting you all the time?
Yeah, I'm playing the Bluebird in Nashville on Tuesday night. It's sold out. It's a sold out show. It's been sold out for a month.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I'm playing up in Fitzgerald's in Chicago, and it's nearly sold out, you know, for a month. And we'll probably sell it out by the time we get over there. So, yeah, that's how it is. There's a certain terrain that you do go through with promoters and stuff. But the fans, yeah, they come to the shows. And so if you can get the word out, they come out. And so I'm really looking forward to going. Yeah, touring is hard, man. It's very hard, but like it's really rewarding when you do have people that come out and want to tune into the music that way. And so, yeah, I do enjoy that.
And do you find that having sometimes the double bill, because you've got Dan Stewart with some dates, haven't you, in the UK and Europe, and then you've got some with Sid Griffin as well. Has that sort of been a happy marriage for both artists and also audience members as well?
Oh, I love playing with Sid, man. It's the greatest, you know. I mean, I go way back with Sid, and I love Sid's music, and we have a lot of the same, you know, things in music we love, like Doug Somm and all that kind of stuff. We're both, like, huge fans of Roger McGuinn and Doug Somm and all that. So we go way back, and he knows a lot of the same people. And so it's, you know, it's very sympathetic, and he opens up the shows, and he's very wonderful to work with. I love working with Sid. He's, you know, a great guy, you know, so that works fine. You know, it doesn't, you know, usually I'm not really on a double bill, but I am in the States with a guy that I like named Ben Delacour, and we're traveling around together, but I don't do it that often.
Yes. And with Dr. Moan, was this all written and recorded during the lockdown period? Was this all and sort of recorded in a home studio?
No, it wasn't recorded in a home studio. I don't have a home studio. I just record my songs at home on my phone or something, or on a cassette player. And then, I wrote them all on the piano here because I was kind of depressed. It's the lockdown, like we were all, going crazy. And then, I'm in a room with a piano, and I just got up every day, had a cup of coffee, and, sat at the piano for hours. And I was trying to learn how to play, like, Jimmy Yancey and that kind of thing, and doing some monk stuff as well. I'd been playing at a church called the Church of St. John Coltrane, which is a Black Orthodox church and African Orthodox church in San Francisco. And I was playing piano with them regularly. So when the pandemic hit, I was playing piano, but I really had a lot of time to get on the piano here at the house, which I hadn't had much time to do. And then I was like playing other people's material, and then songs started to come, and I wrote the whole album here at the piano here in my pad. And then I recorded at this guy's place. I had to find a piano. So Danny Eisenberg is a piano player here in California. And he steered me to this place. Oh, they've got a 1905 Steinway, upright piano at the studio. And it was up north in a place called Novato, north of the city, about half an hour north, 45 minutes north, something like that. And I would drive up there every day, and we recorded the album up there at that studio.
Fantastic. And is this the first one that's on Sunset Boulevard Records?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I'm trying to remember what happened, but we made a record on Bandaloop. I don't know if you ever heard Midnight Broadcast, but Midnight Broadcast is one of my best records, but it's also my most obscure record. And it's on this label called Bandaloop. And I saw it at the gigs, and I'll have it at the gigs in London, Sunset Boulevard Records has a bit more of a profile.
Right, that's quite good. Do you manage to sort of, as a sort of solo traveling artist, do you manage to sort of take your merchandise with you at the same time and sort of set all that up, or do you have set up all your merchandise in? Is that something that you have to do?
Oh, yeah. I don't have a lot of merchandise, but I sell records. I wish I had. I don't do T-shirts or anything. I wish I should have some, skull caps or something, but I don't. And so, it's actually a good idea. I just thought of that just now. Should have a hat like that.
Yes.
Case on a Dr. Moan or something. But I don't have that. So, I just sell records. Yeah, I do sell.
That's cool. And also, because you've had such a sort of long period in history in music, have you started or archived your work, your sort of flyers, your sort of, I don't know, different recordings, because you must have an amazing archive of both kind of ephemeral material as well as recorded material?
Yeah, I've got a lot of stuff. We have a lot of boxes of stuff around here, and I put all my old writings, and, I don't know what's going to ever happen with an archive. I don't know if I'm famous enough to have anybody care about an archive, but, I do have quite an archive of stuff. And I have a book that has all my, a lot of lyrics in it. This is this book I put out. But it's kind of like just a little book, it's not that interesting, but it's got about 100 different songs in it. But, I have these crates I bought. They're they seal up so that the things inside don't get ruined. But I mean, I have notebooks full of stuff back to 1970, six and, all that kind of stuff when I was in the Nerves.
Yes.
And so, I've got tons and tons of material and set lists and flyers from gigs from back in the 1902, when we were playing with the Ramones. I got the Max's Kansas City, advertising and, all that kind of stuff. So I've got quite a bit of stuff like that. But, I'm living in the present. I don't really curate my past. I'm always trying to write new songs. So I'm writing a new album now. And that's more what I'm concerned with.
But yes, absolutely.
There is that stuff,
And with the new material, is it something that you have to study at home, or can you take it out when you're on the road and sort of fiddle around with bits and pieces?
Anywhere I'm with a guitar or a piano, I'm with it,
Yes. And has the process changed much over the decades with your songwriting and the way you put material together?
It's weird, David. It changes every record. I can't seem to do a record without wanting to change it. And so I'm always using a different, in many ways it's the same because it's still my mind and my heart and my, music, but I change the way I get it down and the way I deal with it. So it's different right now. Yeah.
It's different, but look, we're up to the magic moment. I'm aware of the time, actually. Just last then, if you could have whispered something to your 16-year-old self starting out in this interesting and fascinating world. Is there anything in particular that you would have whispered to them in probably 1969?
To what? To wish what?
If you could have whispered something, some bit of advice or some direction that you thought, oh, that would have been quite a good thing to have done or not done. Is there anything that you would have just told them, even if that 16-year-old self would have ignored you?
I would have taught myself how to sit still and just let things come instead of in music. You know, for a long time, I had a really hard time accessing my, taking the right. I learned so much about how to write, you know, that I guess I would have passed on some of those things, you know. When I was early, in the early days, it was like a miracle. Every time it still is, but like it was such a miracle to be able to write a song. And,
yes,
it was like you had to get. It was like trying to go out and get struck by lightning. Is about the, you know, it was really difficult, and it took quite a long time before I. So I would say learn some patience.
Yes,
and I just didn't have. You know, you can't teach a kid patience though, so I didn't have it.
No,
but, you know, learn to just focus and have patience. You know, but I was really all over the place for so long. You know.
Did you enjoy the work of people like John Martin or Nick Drake? Did those kind of English songwriters kind of, or Richard Thompson and Fairport Convention, did they, you know, they weren't quite a blues tradition. They were more of a, I suppose, acoustic folk, rural kind of vibe to them. Did they sort of come into your consciousness?
I'll tell you who affected me was Bert Jansch. Bert Jansch was like probably, you know, Robin Williamson and Mike Caron.
Yes.
In a big way. I thought they were just great. Bert Jansch is fantastic. And then I listened to Donovan's best writing. And I'd never heard Nick Drake or Richard Thompson or John Martin until the 80s.
Right.
So I heard them. I thought they were great. But I never really heard them. But I heard those other people when I was in the 60s.
And what about Davy Graham? Was it Davy Graham, the guitarist, who did the song Angie? Is it Angie?
Yeah, I only knew that through Paul Simon, though.
Right.
I love his work. You know, I really admire his work, you know. I just got an Archie Fisher record. Have you ever heard him?
Archie, no.
He's one of the guys that, he was like one of the original, you know, with Bert Jansch, you know. He's one of the guys from Robin Williamson. He's like, Archie Fisher is fantastic. There's a record he made in 1976 that I just bought at a used record place. It just like, it wasn't even a used record store. It was just like a box of junk. And I'm going through it like, holy moly, it's an Archie Fisher record. And I took it home and it's like a great album. Archie Fisher is really good. He's like kind of a lot like Bert Jansch.
Yes. Well, we love
much
him.
To Bert Jansch. He's awfully good, you know.
He is good. No, I saw him once in a very small little venue in the middle of the countryside. And
he's wonderful, yeah.
He was a legend. But anyway, look, you've got to hit the road. And well, thank you, Peter, ever so much for this.
All right, David, nice talking to you. You know, drop me a line and we'll come back and do just a little bit more if you want.
Yep. Okay. Take care. See you
all
later.
Right, see you later. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks. Nice talking with you. Thank you.
Bye. And that was me in conversation with Peter Case, talking about his life in music, bands and everything else. And if you want any more information, he's got a very good website, which is petercase.com, Peter Case being one word. He's got all the gigs on there, starting in March and running right through into the summer. Various gigs in America, and also he's going to be coming to the UK, playing with various people, including Sid Griffin, and I do believe Dan Stewart in various places. Anyway, this has been the C86 Show. If you want to contact me, you can. This is David East, or just do C86 Show. Go to, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you'll be able to find a message somehow to send me. And also, all these interviews have been podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, and Podbean. It's true. Have a great week. Stay safe.